It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley Brisbane, your host. Welcome back to a discussion of classic film. This is episode 86, Trouble in Paradise. Trouble in Paradise is a 1932 Ernst Lubitsch comedy starring Miriam Hopkins, Kay Francis, and Herbert Marshall. I don't think that's the credit order, but none of them are alive to punish me for making an incorrect statement. I have three delightful panelists joining me to talk about it. First of all, coming to us live and direct from an undisclosed location near some dinosaurs, it's Randy Dettinga. Hi.
Hi. Long story. Listen to the bootleg. I have some advice, and it's just for you, Shelley. If you run into Miriam Hopkins in the ladies' room, get the heck out of there. I can't emphasize this enough. You're gonna find a purse missing, maybe some earrings also, and maybe a bracelet.
Point taken. Beware of Miriam in ladies' rooms. Also with us, Nathan Alderman. Hello.
Hello. This is the film that puts a whole new spin on the phrase, the Lubitsch touch.
Very touchy. And last but not least, it's David Daylor. Howdy.
Howdy. Have you been to Amsterdam? Have you been to Constantinople? Because it's Istanbul, not Constantinople.
Trouble in Paradise, a very interesting film from 32. Very much a pre-code film, very much an Ernst Lubitsch film. There are people that think it is his best. I'll ask my panelists in due course how they feel about that. But let's start with my usual question about what your experience with this film has been in the past. Nathan, let's start with you. Have you seen this one before?
I have, but only a few months ago because it was talked upon this podcast and I thought I'd give it a try. And man, let me tell you, wow, this film is great. This film is, bring a fan in a bucket. This thing is a spicy meatball.
Do you need a cigarette? Do you need two?
I think everybody in this film needs a cigarette constantly.
Possibly six.
I appreciate you giving me the title for the episode so early. Thanks for that. Randy, how about you? Had you seen this before?
This is my first time seeing it, but I think it's great. It's like, it's pre-code, it's pre-screwball, and it's pre-marital. I mean, I'm not familiar with seeing a lot of pre-code comedies. Most of the pre-codes I've seen are kind of gritty Barbara Stanwyck type dramas. And to see what pre-code movies could do, I mean, this is a really, really sexy movie, and it's just handled with such charm. It's all about, you know, flings and affairs and burglary, but it's really charming.
And David, you and Nathan separately both suggested that we see this. I think you perhaps have the longer of the two in terms of background with this movie. But yeah, how well do you know it?
Oh, I mean, I've seen it a couple of times over the years. It's the film that really started the phrase the Lubitsch touch, right? This is where that all kind of people went, hey, wait a minute, that's really good. And, you know, without it, you can see a line through to bringing up Baby and the Lady Eve and His Girl Friday. Just this, it is proto screwball. It's not screwball. It's more, it's almost like a screwball comedy of manners, right? It's very polite, but it's very... it's very pre-code. It's wonderful. These are adults having adult relationships, and it's very sly. And you can see, I mean, Wes Anderson said it was an influence on the Great Grand Budapest Hotel. You can totally see that. If you've seen Grand Budapest and you go back and watch this, it's like, oh, there is some of the DNA in the background of Grand Budapest.
On the Criterion Collection has a DVD Blu-ray that came out a while back, and the introduction is by Peter Bogdanovich, and he just loves this movie. He thinks it's really pioneering and just a delight, and I think he's right.
Shocked that Peter Bogdanovich would like a movie about a suave, handsome guy who is tempted away from his absolutely perfect for him, hardworking, long-suffering wife by a stunning beauty. Really, just completely baffled.
Not even wife.
Right.
They're not married either.
It's true.
Is well, kind of delightful.
This movie, I think, came up when we were watching To Be or Not to Be. We've also done a Peter Bogdanovich film, What's Up, Doc, for a member special. But in the main show, we did To Be or Not to Be, and we talked a little bit about Lubitsch. And I think I was even surprised that we really hadn't talked about Lubitsch before. And of the actors in the movie, we've only seen Herbert Marshall before. I'm a big fan of Kay Francis and was having trouble thinking about what movie of hers to show, because the thing, if you ask people about Kay Francis, I'm sort of diverging on my own path already, but you ask people about Kay Francis, they talk about what a clothes horse she was and how actually her dialogue was often written to minimize the opportunity for her to not have to say R's because she had a bit of a lisp. Not a lisp, actually. She just couldn't say R's.
I forget the term for it. It's like, right. I'll look it up.
I was with all the other gay kids in speech therapy as a kid, because I'd be like, my name is Wandy.
Exactly. But that's different than a lisp. There's a different term for that. Anyways.
Walters had it, too.
Yes, yeah. She did. Kay was sort of the Warner Brothers big star. I know this is a Paramount film, which we'll get to. Kay Francis was the big Warner Brothers female star before Betty Davis came along and kind of dethroned her. And I was watching the movie recently and thinking about how different they are. So they provided the same sort of financial balm to the studio, but they were very different kind of actors. And then you have Herbert Marshall, who's 43 in this movie. And we watched Blonde Venus with Herbert Marshall and Marlene Dietrich, because I just think that's a wonderfully weird movie. I think I forced Nathan to watch that one with me.
So weird. And traumatizing.
And Nathan wondered, not inappropriately, how in the world was Herbert Marshall a leading man? This movie is how in the world leading
Herbert
Marshall.
Yep, this is why. Yeah. I did not get it. I first saw Herbert Marshall in Foreign Correspondent. I saw him in Blonde Venus, and I did not get it. From the first shot here, you get it.
Oh, you totally get it.
Yeah.
The term is rhoticism. R-H-O-T-A-C-I-S-M.
Rhoticism.
Is it the same? Is it the same as a lisp, or is it a separate?
It's a separate thing.
Yeah.
It's the R's as W's.
And
is almost totally S's.
And our third lead is Miriam Hopkins, who we have not seen before on LTS. She famously is in films like The Old Maid and Old Acquaintance with Betty Davis, rather. And they have sort of a feudy relationship. And Miriam Hopkins is this Southern blonde actress who it's funny, because when I used to see her in things, I never really thought a great deal about her. But I've since come to believe that she's very much underappreciated, especially as a comedian. And this movie, I think, really showcases that. So we have these three actors. We have Lubitsch, who is at Paramount, which is his home studio. But none of these three actors was really Herbert Marshall, where I've seen him in a lot of RKO things. I'm not sure where his contract was, but this was not a Paramount stable kind of film. It was Lubitsch picking the people he wanted and putting them together in a way that's just has this alchemical property to them. Because I think one of the things about it is these performances are great, but what's really great about them is how they interact together.
Well, it's funny, because Kay Francis had become a star of sorts at Paramount and then was lured away by Warner Brothers, and Paramount was annoyed by that. And eventually she became even more of a star with Warner Brothers, and Lubitsch said, I would like her in this film, and Paramount had to borrow her back. So that had to have taken a little talking
and a little money, presumably, because well, she was pretty top dog by that time at Warner Brothers, even as early as 1932.
Yeah.
We have supporting players that are pretty familiar. Yeah. We have Edward Everett Horton, who we've seen several times here.
Oh, yes.
We have Charlie Ruggles, also a great comic performer. It's not a huge cast, and he makes the most of. There's a lot of furniture doing a lot of work and set pieces and a fairly modest size cast and just really wonderfully crisp dialogue and great performances between actors. Just making it sing. I mean, it's such a good movie. It's really wonderful.
And that one guy who plays the butler in everything, including in Easy Living.
Yes.
Yes.
And he's good in this. He's good in this. All of them are. I can't think of anybody I don't like in this movie.
And one thing that's kind of amazing to me, especially for 1932. And this, you can see this as an influence on Wes Anderson as well. Right up in the beginning, that opening sequence in the hotel where the camera pulls back out of one room and then starts to go seemingly around the building. And there's a very simple cut where it becomes a miniature of the building as it spins around to Herbert Marshall's room, which is a lovely sequence. The film is so beautifully designed with little tricks like that and little visual flourishes and touches. And, you know, the set design is amazing. And they're just the neon signs they designed for the little perfume ad that they used to introduce Kay Francis's character.
That's the dirtiest neon sign I've ever seen anywhere, much less in a movie.
Oh, we need to get you out more. But yeah, they are pretty racy for a Hollywood film, but they're in literally like split second scenes. You know, they had enough of a budget by doing whatever else they did to be able to make those for these just throwaway shots. It's kind of stunning to watch.
There's a lot of that in the set decoration too. Like when they're at the opera, I was just noting the detail of the foyer, the area where they're going from door to door, and they're, you know, they're stealing the bag, they're hiding the bag, the whole thing. And I'm looking around at the set, which has this sort of these rolled wooden edifices over on the walls, and it's just beautifully ornate. And yes, you would want something like that to be ornate. It's a European opera house of some kind, but it's just so needlessly, decadently, wonderfully pretty to look at. And her house, Kay Francis' house, is like that. You know, all the spaces are at least what they need to be, if not more. And, you know, it doesn't feel overdone. It just feels luxurious and pleasant to be in.
They spent the money on the spiral staircase and they got their use out of that thing.
My God.
Blum, 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 blum.
And they had a body double for Herbert Anderson? Herbert Marshall. Yeah, because he was injured in World War I.
Right, he lost a leg.
Right.
And so they actually had, when he's running up and down the stairs, you don't see his face because it's a body double.
So just very briefly, as far as plot goes, you have Herbert Marshall and Miriam Hopkins, who we see them together as ostensibly a pair of titled Europeans, and they're having dinner, and a very sexy dinner. I was going to say romantic, and that's the wrong word. It's very sort of sexy, flirty dinner conversation, and clearly things are going to progress. And what progresses is that we find out that Herbert Marshall is a crook, and then she finds out that he's a crook, and then he finds out that she is a crook. And so they have this in common. Neither of them is the titled nobility that they appear to be. They get together as a romantic couple, and then they go through Europe and they pursue their robbing ways, and they finally end up in Paris. And they met in Venice, and they end up in Paris, and they meet Kay Francis, who owns a perfumery. I don't know whether that's something she inherited, whether it's a family money kind of thing, or whether she built that business. I get the impression she doesn't really work in the business. She's chairman of, you know, she's got a board of directors, but her working is not a huge part of the movie. But anyway, she is independently wealthy, and Herbert Marshall, it's not that they meet cute. He steals her bag, okay? Or Miriam Hopkins and he steal her bag. And in the process of returning it, he ingratiates himself into her life and becomes her secretary, and thus many hijinks pursue thereafter.
You know, he kind of wins her over by throwing out of her office a comically exaggerated stereotypical anarchist/Marxist.
Yes.
But that guy has a point. It's the Depression, and this lady's buying a 125,000 franc handbag. Maybe he spit a little too much on all those fooies, but, you know, that dude's not wrong.
He was also funny.
The beginning scene of the movie is really interesting, that what Lubitsch He didn't want to do a typical scene where you would set a place. You know, Venice, you would show the gondolas. Maybe you'd have like a shot zooming into the town, some kind of typical way. This, you know, like in Paris, you'd show the Eiffel Tower. He didn't want to do that, so he worked with the other everybody else working on the film for like 3 days to figure out how can we set them where in Venice without doing this stereotypical way of starting a movie. And that's when they started with the garbage guy throwing garbage on a gondola, the garbage gondola, and singing. And that kind of tells you right from the very beginning, this is about the darker side of this glamorous place. This is there's something unique about this movie because we're not starting with how fabulous Venice is. We're starting with kind of the deep underground of Venice.
Yeah, but it's not at all a dirty or a down and dirty sort of movie. I mean,
no,
we're very quickly
it's just like
we're gonna see
like kind of maybe we're not gonna see the prettiest parts. We're gonna and then we see Everett Horton just been robbed. by his tonsil focused doctor,
and then we see the pair of ladies of the evening who were going to visit him in his room before he got robbed, which is pretty interesting. I did really like that first shot of the gondola filled with garbage because I felt like it had some thematic weight. Not only was it unique, but you know, this is a film about facades and what lies behind them. And I thought it was a neat way of puncturing that facade of the loveliness of Venice by showing you the quotidian stuff that goes on, that has to go on to make Venice run. I really like the way this film, Kay Francis, Miriam Hopkins, and Herbert Marshall all play their roles as if they know they're in a bad melodrama. And they're always like subverting and winking at that fact. And they both like to you, the viewer, and within the world of the film, they all seem to know that they're like giving each other lines, but they're all, especially Miriam, Kay Francis, they're always in on the joke. And I really like that. Kay Francis knows that she's getting a line and she's just given a good line right back and she's having fun doing it. It almost reminded me of Hot Fuzz in that this feels like a parody of a thing that is also a perfect example of that thing. In this case, a swanky, effervescent society comedy.
But it kind of builds the relationships between the characters, too, because I think they're giving each other those kinds of lines in that sort of exaggerated manner. But it's also flirty. It's sexy. It's they're both bantering. They're all bantering at the same sort of level. And they're, you know, trying to outdo each other and trying to say, you know, well, here, I'm going to do something cool. And they do it. And Kay Francis has done other comedies. She's more, and also done a lot of melodramas. And I think she's actually kind of a revelation in this film. If you've seen a lot of Kay Francis movies, I think probably this is one of her absolute best performances because she is having fun with it. And she is in on the joke. And she isn't so much just a person wearing beautiful clothes and sort of sweeping in and being, in many cases, the one female lead in the movie. She has this role as, you know, the rich, elegant woman who clearly is, she's kind of flaky, but she's managing her own life just fine, thank you very much. But she's funny as well and is obviously capable of being besotted by Herbert Marshall, as is Miriam Hopkins. And it's a lovely, delightful, fun. All the performances are just so fun to watch.
And they turn it around nicely when Marshall gets utterly besotted by her and the power dynamics just completely flip. I mean, when she snaps her fingers, man, whew. You get where Herbert Marshall's coming from in that moment. It's so funny. This film is so effervescent and so sparkly and so sophisticated and so elegant. And it is so horny on main. I mean, all of these people are down bad for each other. It is wild.
And that's the thing. Like, if somebody said to you, why is this pre-coat? You could say that. You could say that they're horny, but you couldn't say, well, there's a lot of flesh or there's a lot of beyond suggestive. I mean, there is suggestive dialogue, but to quote it would make not as much sense out of context. I mean, certainly there are lines that you can quote that give you that impression. But the pre-codeness of it has to be seen in larger chunks than in just the sort of like, well, it's pre-code because so-and-so wasn't wearing clothing or because of those ladies of the evening. And it's also pre-code in terms of its attitude toward the profession that Miriam Hopkins and Herbert Marshall occupy. They don't get punished at the end for being, you can have movies with thieves and burglars and the like, but somehow they have to get their comeuppance at the end. Spoiler alert, they don't.
And this is a film, I mean, it's about the undercurrents, right? And it's about chemistry. You know, it's this, there's an electricity between the three of them. It's kind of like the electricity between, say, Bruce Willis and Cybill Shepherd in Moonlighting, mm-hmm. right? You could have them standing still and looking at each other, and you know exactly what is going through all of their minds, right? You don't get that in a lot of movies. To this extent.
Yeah, there's that incredible scene where Miriam Hopkins is packing and she is humming a song to herself, but she is suspicious that Herbert Marshall may be fooling around on her. And you just watch her and she does it all with like stopping and starting the song and changes in her facial expression. It's an incredible piece of acting.
Another thing I like about the way they present the love triangle, and they point out in some of the things I was reading today that Lubitsch likes love triangles. There are a number of movies that have them in them. What I like about this love triangle is it's not pitting the women against each other in terms of, okay, we're going to have a climactic catfight or stare down, or one person is going to put the other person down. Both of the characters, they only have a couple of scenes together, as a matter of fact. And in both cases, in a lot of these kinds of movies, or what by which I mean, you know, romantic comedies, if you have a love triangle, it's very clear who the man or who the third person should end up with. And it's very clear that one person, for whatever reason, is cast out of the triangle, either because the person doesn't like them or because they've done something that they shouldn't have done. In this case, you end up liking all three of the protagonists at the end. You don't sort of feel this, well, it was a triangle, but we, you know, took the one person away and cast her off. She ends up not getting Herbert Marshall, but they do so in an adult, sophisticated, they break them up in an adult, sophisticated sort of way that allows all three of those characters to go on with their lives. Two of them just happen to be together. So I enjoyed the triangle without a triangle aspect of it.
Yeah. So Peter Bogdanovich, in his intro to the DVD Blu-ray, he kind of gives the impression that we're going to see a throuple. Mm-hmm. And my friend and I both watched the DVD, watched the intro and the movie, and both of us, we talked about it later, and we were like, but Peter Bogdanovich made us think that there's going to be a threesome in this movie. And we were surprised there wasn't. But I was wondering what you guys think. Is Peter projecting, or was there any hint that they might end up being a throuple?
I was waiting to actually bring up the idea of a throuple, because you could totally believe it with these three.
I mean, this Design for Living, To Be or Not to Be, I may have said this before, but I feel like Ernst Lubitsch believes there's no problem that cannot be solved with polyamory.
That's right. Talk about your Lubitsch touch.
Indeed. Yeah, I think whether we're supposed to take that away or not, I don't think Lubitsch would be the least bit horrified if you said, I kind of got those vibes. And yeah, Peter Bogdanovich is not somebody I want to take guideposts toward sex in movies from. No. But at the same time, no. you see what you see. You see what's there. So,
well, I was thinking about the pre-codeness of it. There's a scene where Miriam Hopkins and Herbert Marshall are canoodling on a couch, and then the couch is empty.
And, yes.
And because they've gone somewhere else for a little more canoodling. I don't think you would have seen that. I mean, you would have seen something hinting, you know, at a postcode movie. I mean, movies during the code period. I think you might have seen some hinting, but it wouldn't have been so blatant.
Yeah, there's a subtlety, even as blatant as it is in this, there's still a subtlety to it, right? You still have to fill in the blanks. And yeah. And even being pre-code, he gets away with a lot, you know. It reminded me of there's a scene in I think it's a third season Star Trek where, you know, if you watch Star Trek carefully, Jim Kirk doesn't actually sleep with as many women as we think, but he does sleep with a few. And in one of those scenes, they cut away as, you know, it's a romantic clinch. And when they come back to the two of them, the alien woman is brushing her hair and Kirk is pulling on his boots. And it's pretty clear. Yes. Okay. Something has happened. And the sensors didn't notice it. And this is a much more fun version of that kind of subtlety.
I think that the things that are less subtle, though, even are, he did get away with a lot. There are a couple scenes where Marshall and Hopkins are seated across from each other and they're not touching. They're nowhere near one another. And then he comes toward her and instead of sitting on the couch next to her or holding her hand or whatever, he just full on lays himself on top of her. And even when they're standing up and when he's pickpocketing her and she's pickpocketing back, it's very physical. And it's not just that they're touching, it's that their bodies are pressed together. And you don't see that a lot in post-code or even pre-code. There are a lot of pre-codes where what constitutes pre-code, again, has to do with what you're wearing or what the situation of the people is, but not so much the physical sexual chemistry. And this movie has so much more sexual chemistry than almost any pre-code I can think of.
There is a comfortable intimacy between all of these characters.
Yeah, yeah. But it's also fraught in the sense that there's sexual tension and sexual dynamics. So they're comfortable in their own intimacy. There's no, oh my God, I'm going to clutch my pearls because I've been presented with a sexual proposition. They're all very comfortable in their own sexuality, but they're also, they're flirting. The reason people flirt is because they're trying to establish their relationship to that other person, and how far can I go? How far does that other person want to go? Where are we headed? That's what flirting is about. And so there's a lot of this when he's getting to know, because we see him meet both women for the first time in this movie. And it's not just that he's not the only one doing the flirting. Both of those women are quite capable of holding their own in a flirting and in a romance situation, as we see, but they're very comfortable with them. I wouldn't say that so much that they're comfortable with the intimacy enough that they have to stop flirting. They're comfortable with their own sexuality that they can do it comfortably.
Does a bee bee?
Something like that.
I mean, speaking of birds, I mean, Herbert Marshall spends the entire film pursing his lips and leaning forward until he is inches away from Kay Francis, Miriam Hopkins, doesn't matter, even some dudes. It's almost like he's a mama bird about to, you know, deposit food into the baby chick's mouth. And yet somehow it works because it's so Pepe Le Pew. It's so over the top. It's just the very picture of the ardent society lover. It works so well, and I don't understand why, but it works.
Yeah, he's not menacing. Neither is he laughable. I mean, it's funny because he's not, you know, a Valentino or a Gable or whatever the conventional attractiveness is supposed to be, but it's not ridiculous. I mean, he's a man in his 40s who does not look as good as a matinee idol, but he isn't repellent in any way. And obviously, Kay Francis and Miriam Hopkins are perfectly happy with his attentions.
He's smooth. I mean, he glides through this movie like no one else I've ever seen on screen. And I love the way he turns every conversation into a game of psychological warfare. He is always one step ahead of the people who are trying to outsmart him. And he's always using these really clever psychological tricks to distract them, to confuse them, to get their minds focused on another topic. It's really amazing to watch.
Well, and when he is Kay Francis' secretary, because he, after they meet and after he returns the bag in order to get the reward from her and he becomes her secretary, he's actually doing good work for her in terms of not allowing the board of directors to get what they want at her expense. And he's basically taking care of his clients, so much so that all the other people in her life, they may be suspicious of him, but mostly they would just like access to Kay Francis again, because now they know they have to go through him in order to get to her, because he's pretty much become her bird dog, which is super interesting, because even though you know what he's up to and that his goal is to not only win her trust, but then take her money away from her, he's doing this really interesting job of basically managing her life.
And again, it's kind of a reversal of expected roles, right? She is the woman in charge of the company. She's his boss, quote unquote. And so there's an interesting dynamic there.
And she doesn't jump into the sack with him right away. I mean, I don't think they never actually get to jump in the sack, right?
Oh, I don't think they spend any time in an actual bed, but
there's places. There's a long period of attraction because I think both of them are sort of feeling out the situation as to what, you know, she wants to know a little more about him, I think, but she's perfectly, you know, she wants to take him to bed. He's first focused on his task of robbing her, and then he falls for her, and it takes a while for them to sort of negotiate that dynamic, but once they do, it's on, man.
Because I thought that last, you know, the last night that he's supposed to leave with Miriam Hopkins on the train, and then he's like, well, let's leave tomorrow, because, you know, and he said something, it's like 11 o'clock p.m., assignation. You know, I felt like he was postponing the train trip because he's like, well, now I finally get to get it done, and so we can just leave on the train in the morning, dear.
He's got to open that safe.
Well, so to speak.
You know, we can
find
talk
the
about,
jewels.
We can talk about the sexiness in this movie for days, because there is days worth of sexiness to talk about, but I was really impressed at how this movie is firing on all cylinders. The dialogue crackles. The visual jokes are really clever. I mean, the way they show the passage of time at the opera by having the pages of the score that the conductor is using flip fast.
Which, if you watch carefully, it's actually a split screen. And it's kind of like in Bringing Up Baby, where it slightly overlaps at times and doesn't quite work. So I'm curious how that effect was done and why.
But also, if the audio is great too. I mean, there's the recurring motif of O Sole Mio that cues you into what Edward Everett Horton's character is thinking. And if you listen at the opera, they are singing in English, and they are singing the dumbest, most basic plot of an opera that you can get, including like, he doesn't love her, he doesn't love her. it's really close, and I only caught that the second time around. Lubitsch is just throwing jokes at you from every direction, and they're all hitting.
Yeah, it was like David was saying, there's so many tiny bits that could be thrown away because it would take time or money or whatever, and Lubitsch says, no, we're going to go for it. We're going to do all those little tiny things.
Poor Edward Everett Horton, his character. He gets robbed, and then robbed by some guy who's just a doctor who insists on inspecting his tonsils. And I thought later on, toward the end of the movie, he's sitting with Charles Ruggles playing the other suitor. And they're chatting and kind of warming up to each other. And I was like, how much are they going to warm up to each other?
I wondered that too.
It was a little hint.
Well, I didn't catch that. I like it.
Yeah, and Edward Everett Horton was, it's generally accepted that he was gay, and I feel like I saw him in Celluloid Closet, that he was one of the actors that got profiled. But so he has this great put upon look to him that, you need a put upon character who has this really elastic face, and you just call. He's got his white courtesy phone ready at all times for these kinds of roles.
But he's good-natured. I mean, a lot of times there are movies of this era where you have sort of the quote-unquote stuffed shirt character, and maybe he exists to be the older suitor for the star, or he's a businessman who's businessing. And I always enjoy Horton and Ruggles, too, because both of them are usually pleasant presences, and whatever it is that they're doing in terms of comic relief, they're not overpowering, and they're not the villain, they're not sputtering and, you know, the like. They're you know, you don't want anything terrible to happen to Edward. You don't really care in great detail about him, but you also don't hate him. So I just enjoy watching him.
You don't really need them in this movie, but it's so entertaining to watch the two of them play off each other. They have such different energies. Ruggles is stoic and reserved, and Horton is twitchy and nervous and high-strung. And to watch them kind of bicker and spat with each other is great. That when Ruggles walks into the jewelry store and Horton is there, and Ruggles says nothing but polite and pleasant things to him, and Horton, reading between the lines, is like, "I'll thank you not to make those insulting remarks to me." I love that.
It's so good.
Or like at the opera when he keeps, you know, entering the box going, goodbye. And then, you know, a few minutes later, goodbye.
And he's been doing it for half an hour.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did love how Herbert Marshall's opera glasses are apparently mounted on a dolly so that they can truck in and move up and down for a closer view of the jewelry.
Oh, I'm looking up the actor who played the butler. I knew we'd seen him before on LTS, and he was in Easy Living and Unfaithfully Yours, looks like. Uh-huh. So we've seen him a couple times, and he looked like his name was Robert Greig, G-R-E-I-G, and it looked like he basically had like dozens of roles as butlers. he had the white courtesy phone for butler roles.
You find your niche and you go with it.
I just always imagine a person like that who works all the time in very small roles, having a very nice middle-class life in Los Angeles. And nobody ever, well, sometimes people might recognize him, but he probably has the benefits of working in the motion picture business without some of the headaches and, you know, I don't know. I like to imagine him puttering in his garden and having a nice life.
Except when he gets invited to fancy parties, everyone's always asking him to hold their coats.
Right, that's true.
I mean, clearly, based on Horton and Ruggles, Eric Bloor must have been busy.
Right.
That's all I'm saying.
It is a total Eric Bloor movie role. Yes, indeed.
Yes,
let's see.
Yes,
what else?
Madam.
What haven't we talked about with this movie? I mean, we all liked it a lot.
One thing I think is interesting is, how do you make a movie about rich people during the Depression without turning off your audience? It seems like from the movies I've seen before, the comedies, you know, you just make rich people look ridiculous. And that's sort of what's happening here. But I wonder if, and then they had the role of the anarchist, you know, kind of bringing in a bit of Bolshevikism in there. But yeah, do you guys think that filmmakers had to think about how do we portray rich people when the Depression is going on?
Well, I think it helps that when we're introduced to Madame Collet, she is being told, well, we need to cut salaries for our workers by a bunch of rich stuffed shirts. And she says, nope, bye. And then later, she gets Herbert Marshall to cut the board's salary instead. Right. I think that's a quick bit of shorthand to get the audience on her side. I would like to say quickly, though, that 1932 and they end the movie by heading to Berlin. No, red flags. Wave off, guys. Go somewhere else.
And then the crooked board chairman, his name is Adolf.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about it, too, is I think somehow them being the rich people being in Europe was a kind of an inoculation because, oh, we know these odd European people with their titles and their, you know, dressing in tuxedos for dinner or whatever it is they get up to in Europe. I mean, there were plenty of movies, even in the depths of the Depression, about rich Americans. But I think probably there was more need to either humanize them or demonize them than there was if you had a European set movie. That's just a sort of a hunch on my part. I don't really have any proof for it, but it just feels to me like Europeans being, by dint of where they're from, being foreigners, there's something odd and something different. And you can put stuff in like her having care for her worker's salary or the Marxist coming in who has a Russian accent and who Herbert Marshall speaks to in Russian, who's, you know, at that time in Europe, you have people who basically were driven out of Russia during the Bolshevism. So during the Russian Revolution. And so who is that guy? Is he why is there a Bolshevik in Paris? I don't know. I want to know more about that guy. But it just feels different than it feels like in America, you have to talk about institutions like banks and big department stores and corporations. And there are a lot of movies that do that. Most of them at that point in the Depression are not comedies. I mean, later on, you get to something like My Man Godfrey, but I can't think of a movie in 1932 that's quite, I mean, this is, as David said, it's proto-screwball. So it feels like that's the other thing. You have to treat them either in a real screwball way, which will happen later on, or you have to treat them in a real dramatic way and you know, make them into terrible people. And I can have us watch some of those movies, too, because they're not bad. They're just very serious.
And, you know, I mean, even in this triangle, two-thirds of the triangle are trying to rip off the richest third of the triangle, mm-hmm. right? Your heroes are criminals. As he says, I'm a self-made crook, right? And a lot of these films that are comedies, part of it was making the rich people look silly, trying to rip them off, trying to spend their money, waste their money. Or alternately, you had, you know, the Fred and Ginger films, where a lot of them are just sort of these fantasies. It's like, we can't escape our little town, but we can go to Venice, and we can go to Paris, and we can go wherever. I'm trying to remember where Top Hat winds up. Does that winds up in Venice?
Is that
right?
In Paris?
Or is it Paris?
Fresno.
A little bit of both. Well, you know, the raisin capital of the world.
Indeed.
And so, yeah, it's escapism and fantasy, but it's also making them silly, right? You have Edward Horton in several Fred and Ginger films, who is an idiot, but he's rich. So,
well, yeah, the most unusual role I think that I've seen him in, when we had Holiday way back at the very beginning of LTS, he is actually the sort of bumbling proletariat professor who is a friend of Cary Grant's Johnny Case. And so instead of being the rich bumbler, the rich, sophisticated bumbler kind of guy, he's the guy who, when he goes to the big house, is criticized for what he's wearing and for taking the wrong elevator, you know. And so,
right. And even something like Easy Living, you know, the rich man throws his wife's fur coat out the window, and it lands on a poor person. And it's, again, it's about the fantasy. It's about, hey, this could happen to anyone. You could strike it rich. You could hit the lottery or win something or find something by accident.
And I think you get the sense that when they're taking the money from Kay Francis, I think we're meant to believe that she's not going to miss it. It's not like he liquidated her company. When he took her money, he's basically taking a rake off, because he has this plan where some dividend income that she is due, half of it is going to be deposited in cash in her safe per month. And that's the money he's going to take. He didn't sign her company over to himself. He didn't, abscond with everything she owns. And so even though it's not stated, it just feels like we're meant to believe Kay's going to be fine.
He also caught an embezzler who was stealing millions of dollars from her over the past few years. So really, he was just getting a finder's fee for that.
Exactly.
Pretty much.
Well, the original title of this work, it was from a play called The Honest Finder. And they considered naming it. I don't know if it's for that thing that happened, because I don't know how big of a role that plays in the play. But there was some discussion about what to name this movie, Trouble in Paradise, The Honest Finder. None of the names seem great. It's funny because they call Trouble in Paradise is a fine name for a movie. I'm not sure it's a fine name for this movie, but you know, I don't know what I would have called it, honestly.
Well, when they put the words Trouble in Paradise over a picture of a bed at the beginning, you get it. You get it right away, and you're like, okay, I see what the title is about.
Go. One thing this movie made me think about Ernst Lubitsch and all of these foreign directors that came in to the U.S. during this period. He'd been a filmmaker just about 10 years when he came to the U.S. In the early 20s. And I'm just thinking about how you come to the U.S. from Europe, and you don't know the language, you don't know the culture, and within a few years, you are creating masterpieces in a completely foreign language, in a completely foreign culture. And to be able to do that, and to be able to be wise enough to understand what you don't understand, you know, about the culture and the language, someone's going to tell you that, you know, that's not how that would be said, or that's not going to go over as a joke in the U.S., you know, just the wisdom these directors had to be able to make, to adjust from where they're from and how they did filmmaking at home to American filmmaking in so rapidly. I was just thinking, like, what if you took Wes Anderson, early Wes Anderson, and put him in Poland and had him make Polish movies? You know, how much of a stretch that would have been.
Now I really want to see that.
And Lubitsch wrote, like, Lubitsch is not credited as the writer, but he worked, this guy Samson Raphaelson, I don't know his background at all, but he's the main writer, and he wrote with Lubitsch a lot. But Lubitsch also wrote on his films. So I don't know whether, like, I've seen interviews with Billy Wilder, and he came from Germany, and obviously he became fluent in English. But you kind of listen to him speak, and you don't get the sense that he's going to be a director of either sparkling or rapier-like right. dialogue, but he ends up being that. And Lubitsch, it is interesting. I think there are some people who just find what they and I guess too, he's discovered what it's like to communicate in America, but he's also doing it very much his own way. It's not like, oh, Lubitsch copied so-and-so in order to become the filmmaker he did. So whatever sensibility he had on his own, and he managed to translate that to something that a U.S. audience could understand. And it may be that it's just, that's what genius is, right?
And I was reading that he liked to act out to the performers what he wanted them to do.
He had been an actor early on in Germany.
Yeah. So he did that much more than a typical director would do.
Yeah, and Raphaelson was a New York-born playwright who had a decent career in the theater before he went into film. But in addition to working on this and The Shop Around the Corner and Heaven Can Wait, he also did Suspicion with Alfred Hitchcock, which
interesting.
Is pretty good. And he wrote a textbook on the quote, the human nature of playwriting. So yeah, he had a fair career.
We did Suspicion on LTS, didn't we?
No, we talked about it. We could. It's funny because I've always thought of myself as not being a Hitchcock fan. And I think what I mean by that is once he gets to the 50s and he gets sort of weird yeah. about blonde women, I'm less yeah. interested. But we've done several Hitchcock films, and I have thought of a few more that I'd like to do. And most of them happen before he gets weird in the late 40s. Although Rope, maybe. That might be the latest Hitchcock I'd want to do.
But anyway. The only after Rope, I mean, I do like Rear Window, but it's North by Northwest, and then
oh, that's
everything
true.
Else.
Yeah.
I love North by Northwest.
I'm a Rear Window guy.
Interesting
guy
one
all
is
the way.
There's a really interesting one that's not as well known called The Wrong Man from 1956. It's based on a real life mistaken identity case, and it has a very documentary feel that there's actually a new book that just came out a few months ago, and I reviewed it for Noir City magazine. It's about the movie The Wrong Man and then the real life case that inspired it, and how the actual real life people, a man and his wife, worked with Hitchcock. So it's an unusual movie because it's very, it's basically like a almost very documentary feel, which is unusual for Hitchcock.
I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it. I might take a look. Anything else about Trouble in Paradise, friends?
I mean, if you think that old movies are boring and stiff and unsexy, you should watch this movie. It is none of those things.
As soon as I was finished watching it, the last thing in my notes is, no one thieves like Gaston or deceives like Gaston or conceives of such cons as he leaves like Gaston. And I stopped there because, I have a life.
The musical version of Trouble with Paradise coming to
which
a theater near you.
Paramount tried to do in 1948, and the Hayes office wouldn't let them because it was an immoral film. This film was disappeared until like 1968 or so.
Yeah, and then it was restored, and I was glad to see that it's gotten a Criterion release. I knew it had been found and restored because nobody had seen it. For both that reason and also I think it got caught in there were a lot of Paramount movies from pre-1948 that got caught up in licensing and legal issues, which is a huge thorny thing that I've tried to write about before, and it's caused my head to hurt a great deal. But now a lot of those films are available to see, so that's good.
But yeah, Paramount knew this would make a good musical, and I'm surprised no one's really tried. I should get out my notepad.
Get on that, David.
yeah.
Well, friends, thanks so much for being here for our discussion of Trouble in Paradise. And thank you, David, Nathan, and Randy, for being along. Next week, we will do a very different film called Night of the Hunter from 1955. That will be episode 87. This is episode 86, in case you're counting. Friends, if you want to subscribe to this podcast, if for some reason you haven't done that already, please go to theincomparable.com/LTS. If you want to keep in touch with us or find out when new shows are coming out, you can find us on all the socials at Lion Tower Shield, because S's cost extra. We also have an email address. Remember those? LTS@theincomparable.com. See you next week. Bye now.